Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am covering in this audio Genesis chapter 7, verses 13 through 24. I'm going to call this section, The Waters Cover the Earth. We're in the middle of the discussion of Noah's flood. Our context is this, in the first 12 verses of chapter 7, Noah has loaded the ark, and the waters have started to come from the sky and from beneath the earth. So we start in Genesis 7, verse 13, and we'll read also verses 14 and 15. On that same day, Noah, along with his sons Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Noah's wife, and his three sons' wives, entered the ark with them. They entered it with all the wildlife according to their kinds, all livestock according to their kinds, the creatures that crawl on the earth according to their kinds, all birds, every fowl, and everything with wings according to their kinds. Two of all flesh that is the breath of life in it entered the ark with Noah. Well, let's just cover some basic stuff very quickly. Kinds, of course, means the category of life which life cannot cross the boundary of the kind that it's in to another kind. It's an artificial distinction is what the Bible calls it. We have, it's not artificial, it's a real distinction. We have other artificial distinctions such as species and genus, I guess you'd say, and all of that. But these are kinds. You don't see any movement from one kind to another. For example, a dog kind might be a coyote, a wolf, a dog, and there's all kinds of dogs. But all of that is the canine kind. And you're not going to get a cat to cross with a canine because that's the way God made it. Also, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, those are Noah's three sons. We'll cover them when we get to the Table of Nations, chapter 10. And let's make a few comments about the animals that entered the ark. Verse 14, they entered it with all the wildlife according to their kind. So we got wildlife, livestock, creatures that crawl on the earth, and birds. Four types of living creatures. Now, it's interesting that those four types of living creatures are also listed in Genesis 1, 21, and 25. I'm in Genesis 1 now. It says verse 21 says God created the large sea creatures. And then in verse 21, he created every winged bird. Well, actually, the sea creatures is not mentioned in Genesis 7 because they're going to live in the water. They're not going to be killed by the flood. But the other four kinds of living creatures are mentioned in the Genesis creation story as well as the flood story. Every winged bird in verse 21. In verse 24, we got livestock. That's number two. Creatures that crawl. That's the third type of life. And number four, wildlife. And of course, livestock is tame farm animals like cows, sheep, oxen, goats. Creatures that crawl. That would be insects, lizards, and spiders and so forth. Wildlife of the earth would be lions and tigers and bears and things like that. Now, all of that was created. Now, I mention this because we're going to see later that there are many parallels between the creation account and the flood account. The flood wipes the earth back to the situation it was at the creation, at the beginning of creation in Genesis 1, because God's got to start over because of the sin of man. And that's one of the parallels right there. I mean, even the words are the same. Genesis 7, verse 14, wildlife. Genesis 1, verse 24, wildlife. Genesis 7, at the flood, livestock. Genesis 1, at creation, verse 24, livestock. Genesis 7, at the flood, creatures that crawl. Genesis 1, verse 24, at the creation, creatures that crawl. Genesis 7, verse 14, all birds. Genesis 1, at the creation, verse 20, every winged bird. So you see the parallel there. Verse 13 says, two of all flesh that has the breath of life in it. Two, that means a pair. That means male and female, as he says in the next verse. And it doesn't mean two pairs. It means two single people, two single creatures making up one pair. There were actually seven pairs of the clean animals, if you recall from chapter 6, or chapter 7, previous chapter, chapter 6. But as John Gill says, this is not referring to pairs. It's referring to individuals, one male and one female in the pair. So two by two, they entered the ark. Now that's two, that means pairs of all flesh. Seven pairs of clean animals and one pair of unclean animals. Of course, they had to be more clean animals because they would probably have to sacrifice some of them. They had to eat some of them as compared to unclean animals, which wouldn't be eaten. So there's more. But I say that because most of the time we just think of each kind of animal only had a male and a female. one pair went on the ark. No, that's only for unclean animals. The clean animals had seven pairs. And notice that it's flesh that has the breath of life in it. That refers to animals. Animals are said to have that breath of life, just like Adam had the breath of life in it. Plants do not have the breath of life in them, and so Adam is not carrying plants onto the ark. Now we go to Genesis 7:16. Those that entered, male and female of all flesh, entered just as God had commanded him. Then the Lord shut him in. Now, this is an interesting question. How did the Lord shut him in? Noah goes into the ark. His seven companions go in with him, his family members. How does he get shut in? Did the Lord give Noah assistance in nailing the door shut from the inside? Because oftentimes the scriptures talk about God doing something directly, even though there's an intermediate means to get it done. I think that's probably what it is. I mean, you could speculate that it was Jesus appearing as the angel of Jehovah that came in and nailed it shut. John Gill says angels could have done it. I don't think so. I just think it means with God's assistance, he helped Noah nail the door shut. Chapter 7, Genesis 7, verses 17, 18, and 19. The flood continued for 40 days on the earth. The waters increased and lifted up the ark so that it rose above the earth. The water surged and increased greatly on the earth, and the ark floated on the surface of the water. Then the water surged even higher on the earth, and all the high mountains under the whole sky were covered. Now the scripture here is silent on exactly when the ark lifted off the ground, when it started floating. It could have been on day one of the 40 days of rain. It could have been on day 40. Well, John Gill says a possible way to interpret this is it actually took 40 days for the water to get high enough to float the ark off the earth. That's reasonable, I think. That's a big ark. Take a lot of water to get it off the earth. Of course, it's going to take more than just the rain. It's going to take the water running out from the subterranean rivers also to raise the ark. But let's assume that 40 days goes by of rain and then the ark lifts up. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says that the ark seems to have been raised so gradually as to make daily rises imperceptible to the inhabitants. Well, who knows? I don't know. We see the ark floating on the surface of the water. The seas would have been rough. Again, there's going to be a lot of water coming from under the ground, from volcanoes and earthquakes, as John Gill's editor points out. But the ark was large enough and shaped so it would be almost impossible to upset, as John Gill's editor also points out. So the ark's floating. And now we get to verse 19, which is a key verse in controversy between the local flood advocates and the global flood advocates. Verse 19, Genesis 7. Then the waters surged even higher on the earth, and all the high mountains under the whole sky were covered. Now, the reason that's a difficulty for the local earth people is that you got mountains covered with water. How in the world is a local flood going to be contained in Mesopotamia if the mountains on the edges of Mesopotamia are covered with water? We'll see later, it also is 20 feet above the mountains. How are you going to contain that to a local flood? Okay, so let's take a pause here and let's look at some arguments that this flood was a universal flood, which is the majority traditional opinion. First of all, there are a lot of phrases in the scriptures in Genesis 1 and the other scriptures dealing with the creation account, just Genesis scriptures in Genesis in general, talking about creation, that match phrases that deal with the flood. And so since the first creation, since Genesis 1, it talks about the creation of the whole world, waters cover the whole earth, it would make sense then that the parallel passages that refer to Noah's flood that use so many of the same phrases that are in the creation story in Genesis 1, that these parallel terms, the common terminology, tends to show that both passages are talking about a universal inundation of the planet. So let's look at some of those terms. First of all, the earth. Genesis 1:1 says, In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Genesis 1:2, now the earth was formless and empty. Genesis 1:10, God called the dry land earth. Now that's the creation. How about the flood? Genesis 6:12, God saw how corrupt the earth was, for every creature corrupted its way on the earth. Genesis 6:13, that God said to Noah, I've decided to put an end to every creature, for the earth is filled with wickedness because of them. Therefore, I am going to destroy them along with the earth. So we're talking about earth in both passages. Now, that's not dispositive, of course, but it's an indication. Now, how about the phrase upon the face of the earth? Now, here's some scriptures where it apparently means the whole earth. Genesis 1, this is the creation account. Genesis 1:29. God also said, look, I have given you every seed-bearing plant on the surface of the entire earth, or on the face of the entire earth. Genesis 11:4. This is the Tower of Babel. The Tower of Babel is not either creation or the flood, but the idea, it looks like it's referring to the whole earth and not just Mesopotamia. Genesis 11:4, and they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the sky. Let us make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we will be scattered over the face of the old earth. Will they scattered over Mesopotamia? Will they scattered over the face of the whole planet? Genesis 11:8-9, so from there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. Sounds like the whole earth, does it not? And they stopped building the city. Therefore, its name is called Babylon, because for there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth. And from there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. All right, so that phrase, face of the whole earth, is used at the Tower of Babel. It's used at the flood. It's also used at the creation account in Genesis 1:29. God also said, look, I've given you every seed-bearing plant on the surface of the entire earth. That just sounds like the whole world. It's not slam dunk argument now, but it sounds like it. Now let's look at the phrase face of the ground. Now here's some scriptures where it apparently refers to the whole earth. Genesis 2 verse 6, but water would come out of the ground and water the entire surface of the land. Again, I guess you could say that's just talking about Mesopotamia, but it sounds like the whole earth, the creation. Now in the flood narrative, we read in Genesis 7:4, 7 days from now, I will make it rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and I will wipe off from the face of the earth. Same phrase. You got the same phrase at creation, same phrase at Noah's flood. Creation was universal, so therefore we would think Noah's flood would be universal. Here's another phrase, another common phrase, under the whole heaven. Now here's some scriptures where it's used to mean universality. Under the whole heaven means the whole planet. Deuteronomy 4:19, and this list is not exclusive, by the way. There's other verses I'm not going to mention. Deuteronomy 4:19. When you look to the heavens and see the sun, moon, and stars, all the array of heaven, do not be led astray to bow down and worship them. The Lord your God has provided them for all people everywhere under heaven. That's not just Mesopotamia. Everybody gets to use the stars. Job 28:24, for he looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. That's not just talking about Mesopotamia. Job 37:3, under the whole heaven he lets it loose, and his lightnings to the ends of the earth. Job 41:11, who has given me that I should repay him? Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine. Well, that has to refer to the old earth. That's not Job talking, whatever is under the whole heaven is mine, Job's. It's whatever is under the whole heaven is mine, God's. That's obviously universal. Daniel 9:12, thus he confirmed his words which he had spoken against us and against our rulers who ruled us to bring on us great calamity. For under the whole heaven there has not been done anything like that was done at Jerusalem. That's obviously talking about the whole earth. All right, so there you got that universal phrase under the whole heaven. We don't have it in Genesis, so this kind of messes up my parallelism a little bit, but we do have it in other scriptures where it means the whole earth. And then the flood narrative, Noah's flood, Genesis 7:19-20, the water prevailed more and more upon the earth, so that all the high mountains everywhere under the heavens, there's that phrase, under the heavens. Okay, so the language tends to make you think that Moses, when he writes Genesis, Genesis 7, talking about the flood, he's talking about a universal flood, a flood over the whole earth. All right, here's the second argument for a universal flood. A local flood would not completely judge mankind for Adam's sin. You got to destroy the whole earth because Adam's sin polluted the whole earth with sin, the whole earth, not just Mesopotamia. The local flooders have to answer that by saying, well, perhaps all of mankind was located in Mesopotamia and hadn't had a chance to spread out yet. Well, this is my idea. That seems hard to believe to me. There were at least 10 generations between Seth and Noah, if you look at the genealogies, and those genealogies almost certainly had gaps. That's plenty of time for people to spread beyond Mesopotamia, folks. Plenty of time. Especially when each person in that genealogy is living in the hundreds of years. That's plenty of time to get beyond Mesopotamia. So that's a weakness in the local flood theory, in my view. Here's the third argument for a universal flood. Worldwide flood stories are everywhere in ancient folk literature, as I'm sure you probably already know. And those flood stories are not local flood stories. They're worldwide flood stories. A worldwide flood is by far the most frequently given cause for universal destruction of the whole planet. So I'm sure that this flood got picked up by nations, ethnic groups, folklore, which folklore, of course, perverted the original account as accurately described in Genesis. In my opinion, that's the best argument for a universal flood right there. Here's fourth argument for a universal flood as opposed to a local flood. God promised no more floods, but there have been a lot more local floods. So if he's promising there'd be no more flood, he's probably talking about no more worldwide flood, because there have been a lot of local floods. Genesis 8:21. This is after Noah got out of the ark. The Lord smelled the soothing aroma, and the Lord said to himself, I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. And I will never again destroy every living thing as I have done. I will never again destroy every living thing. Well, every living thing in a locally flooded region has happened many times. There have been lots of floods that have wiped out everybody living in a small area. So that's kind of embarrassing to the local flood theory. How about Genesis 9:11? I establish my covenant with you, and all flesh shall never again be cut off by the water of the flood. Never, neither shall there again be a flood to destroy the earth. There have been lots of local floods to destroy the land in the local area. This is a covenant that God's making with Noah. Continuing with that covenant in Genesis 9:15, and I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh, and never again shall the water become a flood to destroy all flesh. So there's a promise, no more flood, and we've had lots of local floods, so the flood that was promised is never going to be another one. Must have been a universal flood. Every time there's a local flood, then God must have broken his promise if he said there's not going to be any more local floods. Now, here's how the local flooders answer that argument. They say the flood was universal in judgment, although local in extent. All flesh and the earth was destroyed by the local flood. And, of course, they have to say everything's in Mesopotamia that's destroyed. And so I have to ask, you mean there weren't any animals outside of Mesopotamia? I have a hard time believing that one. Fifth argument for a universal flood. Why build such a big ark if it was just a local flood? The animals outside of Mesopotamia would survive, so you wouldn't have to put so many pairs of animals in the ark. Sixth argument for a universal flood. God could have just told Noah to leave Mesopotamia rather than build an ark. Be a lot simpler. Noah, you need to get out of Dodge here. There's going to be a local flood. It's going to wipe out all your neighbors, but we're going to take you to safety. Here's how a local flood might answer that. Well, God's plan was for Noah and his sons to demonstrate their commitment to the Lord, and that's easier done when they're sitting there in a boat being a preachers of righteousness. Now, here's a quote from them, and I didn't put the site down. I'm sorry, but a local flutter said this, quote, it is true that God could have done this, could have let Noah just leave the area, although there are some good biblical reasons why he chose not to do so. Why did God make the Israelites march around Jericho for 7 days prior to the wall falling down? Well, I can come up with some reasons for that. I'm not going to get into that, but I could. Why did God make the Israelites look upon the bronze serpent to be healed of snake bite in the wilderness? I can give you a good reason for that too. Why did Jesus make the blind man go to the pool of Siloam to heal his blindness? Now, I can't answer that one. He could have just healed him on the spot. As this local flutter continues, were any of these things actually required for God to do his work? Well, no. If you assume a local flood, it is not absolutely necessary for God to send Noah outside the local flood area. God could have built an ark even though it's a local flood, just to make a big point, make a story, to make it show that the righteous was delivered and the bad guys are judged. So the local flooders like to quote 2 Peter 2:4-5 here, which says, God did not spare the ancient world, verse 5, God did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah a preacher of righteousness. He can't preach righteousness if he's running outside of Mesopotamia where nobody can see him. But boy, when he's in that ark, everybody knows who he is. Well, I think the universal flutters have the strength there. I think it would have been just as easy for Noah to leave Mesopotamia. Here's argument number 7 in favor of the universal flood theory. The mountains were covered by 15 cubits of water. That would flood much more than Mesopotamia. The water couldn't be held inside of Mesopotamia if it runs over the mountains surrounding Mesopotamia. We read in verses 19 and 20, the water prevailed more and more upon the earth, so that all the high mountains everywhere under the heavens were covered. The water prevailed 15 cubits higher, and the mountains were covered. A mountain's covered by 15 cubits of water? I mean, a cubit is, there's lots of cubits. Let's say it's a foot and a half cubit. So that's 22 and a half feet of water over the mountains, and those waters are going to be contained in a local flood in Mesopotamia. That's hard to believe. There is a comeback to that, which I'll get to in a minute. The eighth argument in favor of a universal flood is that it took such a long period of time for the water to drain from the earth. Water would drain from a local flood relatively quickly, but a worldwide flood is going to take a long time for that water to go away. Here's a quote from a universal flood advocate. The deluge, this is from a website, I don't have the author, creationist website. The deluge of rain from above and water from the fountains of the deep below continued 40 days, and all the highest mountains were still covered 5 months after the flood began. The tops of the mountains were not seen until after 7 months, and the flood waters were not dried up enough for Noah to leave the ark until 1 year and 10 days had passed. You can read this in Genesis 7:11, verse 17, and chapter 8, verse 14. Such length of time seem commensurate only with a universal and not a local flood. That's a good argument. Argument number 9 in favor of the universal flood. The New Testament sounds much more like the whole earth, the whole world was judged and destroyed, not just a local area. Matthew 24:39, and they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away, so will the coming of the Son of Man be. Now, to be frank with you, that a local flutter could come back and say, if he was an Orthodox putter like I am, even though I'm not a local flutter, this person could say, look, the coming of the Son of Man came and wiped out all the people in the land of Israel. And therefore, the local flood came out and wiped out all the people in the land of Mesopotamia. So I give them that one. Won't stand on that one to prove the universal flood. Luke 17:27, and they were eating, they were drinking, they were marrying, they were being given in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. Again, that's all the people in Jerusalem, AD 70. And so that one doesn't necessarily prove a worldwide flood because Jerusalem is not worldwide. Jerusalem is not analogous to a whole world being flooded. 2 Peter 2:5, God did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a preacher of righteousness with 7 others, when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly. The world of the ungodly. That doesn't sound like Mesopotamia. That sounds like the whole world. Now, I realize translation might have something to do with this, and I'm going to mention another way you can translate some of these land verses, earth verses, to make it land. Here, world, where it says he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly, that could be interpreted with a definition of world, the Greek word is cosmos, to favor the local flood view. For example, here's a definition from Thayer's, the ungodly multitude, the whole mass of men alienated from God and therefore hostile to the cause of Christ. In other words, like worldly people, the world of the ungodly, he just flooded the ungodly people all in Mesopotamia, not in the whole world, not in the whole physical world. But on the other hand, there are definitions favoring a universal flood. For example, the world is from Thayer's, the world, the universe, the circle of the earth. And I think that's the easiest reading of that. God brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly, on the planet that the ungodly were living on. Again, that's not slam dunk. You can defend against that if you're a local flutter. Let's look now at Hebrews 11:7. By faith, Noah, being warned by God about things not yet seen, in reverence prepared an ark for the salvation of his household, by which he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. Noah condemned Mesopotamia, or did he condemn the world? Well, of course, the local flood is going to say he condemned the world of the ungodly and only the ungodly lived in Mesopotamia. But that's not what it sounds like. It sounds like he condemned the whole globe, the whole world. Here's what Gleason Archer, my wife's old professor at my seminary, Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, wrote in 1985. We have the unequivocal corroboration in the New Testament that the destruction of the human race at the time of the flood was total and universal. Hear, hear. That was the 9th argument in favor of a universal flood. Here's the 10th argument in favor of the universal flood. The local flood theory misses the theological point of the flood, which is the cosmic reversal of creation because of man's sin. The universal flood brought the earth right back to where it started. Remember in Genesis 1:2, the earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters. As a commentator named Blenkinsop, and I don't know him, he wrote in 1992, quote, the deluge is an act of uncreation, undoing the work of separation by returning everything to the primeval watery chaos from which the created order first arose. Now, we can show that because there's so many literary parallels between the creation, the original creation at the first of Genesis, and the recreation after the flood, after Noah's flood. For example, the wind over the earth and waters, we see that in Genesis 8:1 and Noah's recreation after the flood, and Genesis 1:2 in the original creation. Division of waters in Genesis 8:1-5 for Noah, and Genesis 1:6-8 for the original creation. The appearance of plants, Genesis 8:6-12, plants appeared after the ark came to rest. Genesis 1, 9-13, plants were created. Appearance of light. Genesis 8, 13-14, light appeared. Genesis chapter 1, verses 14-19, light was created. Sun, moon, and stars. The deliverance of animals. Genesis 8, 15-17, animals were delivered. And also in Genesis 1, 20-23, we have animals together with men, which were a blessing for men and food for men. And we have men made in the image of God and all and such. You can find parallels there between Noah's flood and Genesis. There was a sign of a covenant, Genesis 2, 1 through 3, and in Genesis 9. Now, I could go through that, and I realize that some of that might be controversial because somebody might be stretching it a little bit, whoever came up with these literary parallels, but I don't have time to get into all of to go into a deep analysis of that. But the point is that there are plenty of parallels between the original creation and the recreation of the earth by Noah's flood. Formless and void in both cases. That was the 10th argument in favor of a universal flood. Let's look at argument number 11. There's nothing to hold the water in Mesopotamia only. A local flood would run all out to the surrounding areas. Now, local flooders answer by saying it was a miracle that held the water in. Well, you know, when you have to appeal to miracle, that's usually pretty weak. Although, you know, sometimes miracles do happen. We can't deny miracles if we're Christians. Miracles are everywhere in the Bible, but a lot of times people appeal to miracles when their argument is weak. Number 12, that was argument number 11 for a universal flood. Here is argument number 12. Why put birds on the ark? Since they could fly out of Mesopotamia, if it was just a local flood, they could just fly and avoid the local flood, land somewhere else. Local flooders answer, well, no, birds couldn't do that. The rain would make them it hard to fly. They would be weighted down by that rain. And non-migratory birds have a very localized range. Okay, well, I give you that one. That's a defensive argument by the local flooders. It doesn't prove anything for the local flood. It just cancels one of the many, many, many arguments we have for the universal flood. That was the 12th argument for a universal flood. Let's look at argument number 13. Noah didn't need animals on the ark. He could have just taken animals from outside Mesopotamia after the flood. So what's the point of building an ark and putting animals on it? Animals would have survived outside of Mesopotamia if there was only a local flood. Why go to all the trouble building an ark and putting all those animals on there? Local flooders answer that by saying some animals are only indigenous to Mesopotamia, and that would have been, and so therefore they needed to be saved on the ark. And also, it would be very difficult for Noah to replace his herds by finding animals outside the local area, so it would be just easier to put it on the ark. Easier to build a huge ark like that and put a bunch of animals on there and manage those animals for all the time that they were in that ark? I don't think so, but that's what the local flooders want us to believe. Now, there are implications of the idea that there's only a local flood. I've mentioned three of them as I went through these arguments. Let me isolate those again. Theological implications. The local flood theory misses the theological point of the flood, which is the cosmic reversal of creation. Judgment on the world needs to be started over again. Adam fell, here's a second theological implication. Since Adam fell, doesn't it make more sense that the whole world was judged and destroyed, not just Mesopotamia? All right, those are some general theological implications, but also in particular for six-day creationists, there's some implications. You need a flood because you need to explain the existence. You need a universal flood, not a local flood. A universal flood would explain the existence of the geologic column that you see in the strata of the earth. And if you don't have a flood, you can't explain a lot of that stuff unless you do billions and billions of years, which, of course, six-day creationists don't like. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I've given you a very rough overview of arguments for a universal flood. Now, let's look again briefly at arguments for a local flood. Argument number one, Moses in the flood narrative never uses the Hebrew word tebel, which means the word as a whole. Well, the short answer to that is Moses didn't use tebel in the account of the creation of the whole world either, but he created a whole world, So if God creates a whole world without Tebel, why can't he flood the whole world without the word Tebel? That's not a very good argument, in my opinion. Now, here's a little stronger argument. B, the creation psalm says that waters will not, again, cover the earth. What's the creation psalm? That's Psalm 104, verses 5 through 9. He established the earth upon its foundations so that it will not totter forever and ever. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters were standing above the mountains. At your rebuke, they fled. At the sound of your thunder, they hurried away. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place where you established for them. You set a boundary that they may not pass over, so that they will not return to cover the earth. Now, the verse I want to concentrate on here in this creation psalm is verse 9. You set a boundary that they may not pass over. That means the seas may not pass over this boundary, so that they will not return to cover the earth. And that says, oh, there's not going to be another flood. Now, assuming Psalm 104, 5 through 9 refers to creation week, which almost every commentary says that it does, and I believe it does, then we've got a problem. The universal flood theory's got a problem because in verse 9 it says that a boundary will be set so that there will be no more universal flood. The waters will never again cover the earth. Ooh. Well, first of all, there's possible answers. There are several possible answers. The first answer is that Psalm 104, verses 5 through 9 is referring to the flood, not the creation in Genesis 1 and 2, but it's referring to the flood in Genesis 6 and 7. And if it's referring to the flood, then when God sets a boundary that the waters will not ever pass over the land again, he's saying there's not going to be another flood that wipes out the earth, as we know in Genesis 8, with Noah's covenant. Well, that would solve the problem, but the problem is most people say that Psalm 104 is not referring to Noah's flood, it's referring to creation. Okay. Well, let's assume that and see if we can answer the problem. Noah's flood was an exception. That's possible answer number two. Rich Deem, the local flooder, quotes John Gill and Spurgeon as saying that Noah's flood was an exception to this psalm here that said that no water would ever cross over the boundary of the land and would not cover the earth again. Well, that's a pretty weak argument if on the part of Gill and Spurgeon, in my humble opinion. An exception to the rule. And that's possible, but it's weak. To me, this is my thinking. I didn't get this anywhere, so take it with a grain of salt. My thinking is that the time frame in verse 9, you set a boundary that they may not pass over so that they will not return to cover the earth, that the time frame that that verse is referring to is the time of creation, not the time of Noah's flood or the time at the end of the world or at any time up to the end of the world. It's talking about at the time of creation. So God creates the earth. He covers the earth, sets the earth upon its foundation. Then the waters fled. They hurried away. The mountains rose as the water sank down. The mountains rose up. And then once he got it fixed, once the land popped up and the water settled down into its valleys and oceans, that's it. We're not going to have another flood right now to flood the earth. To me, that's the easiest way to explain it. All right, that's the second argument for the local flood. The third argument for the local flood is that the word eretz, earth, can be translated land, and that's absolutely true. So let's substitute land for earth in Genesis 7:17-19. Then the flood came upon the land for 40 days, and the water increased and lifted up the ark so that it rose above the land. Of course, the local flooders say the land is the land of Mesopotamia. The water prevailed and increased greatly upon the land of Mesopotamia, and the ark floated on the surface of the water. The water prevailed more and more upon the land, so that all the high mountains everywhere under the earth heavens were covered. Okay, well, that sounds nice. The local flooders go on to say that of the 205 instances of Kol Eretz, all the land, Kol Eretz, in the Old Testament, only 40 refer to the whole planet, and some of those 40 are questionable. Well, that sounds nice, but you know what the problem with that is? You're looking at the whole Testament. You got the land of Israel, and there will obviously a lot of the Kol Eretz are going to refer to all the land of Israel. But here, we're talking about creation. And every time that you see Eretz or Kol Eretz referring to creation, sounds a awful lot like the whole world, not talking about just a local land reference. So going out and pulling out a bunch of references to Israel and saying, see there, most of the time Eretz is used as not referring to the whole earth. That doesn't prove a thing, not in my mind anyway. We go down to a fourth argument for the local flood theory. This is a defensive argument. Genesis 7:20, their problem verse says, the mountains were covered as the water surged above them more than 20 feet. That makes it difficult for a local flood to think the water is going to be flowing over the mountains out of Mesopotamia. And how's it going? How are the floodwaters going to be contained in the local area? Well, the local flooders say that this verse should be translated this way. The mountains were covered as the water surged upward more than 20 feet. Instead of saying the mountains were covered as the water surged above them more than 20 feet, it's the mountains were covered as the water surged upward more than 20 feet, not upward over the mountains 20 feet, but just upward. That could be from the ground, not over the mountains. So as the result, the flood was more than 20 feet in total, not 20 feet above the mountains. Well, that's a translation issue. I'm not going to get into that. Plus, it's in Hebrew, and that makes it difficult for me because I don't know Hebrew. But I find this a little questionable. Because even though if you say the water surged upward more than 20 feet from the ground rather than upward over the mountains, the local flooders have still got a problem because that verse, Genesis 7:20, says the mountains were covered. 20 feet of water covers the mountains? That makes no sense. Well, their answer is this. The mountains, the Hebrew word there for mountains, har, like Harmageddon, mountain of Megiddo, har. The word mountains most often refers to hills rather than mountains, so 20 feet could cover the hills. I submit to you, I think that's pretty weak. Here's the fifth argument for the local flood. There's no place for the global flood waters to recede if it was a worldwide flood. Well, I don't know. I'm not a scientist, but I think, why can't the global flood waters recede by sinking back down into those subterranean fissures that opened up when all the water came up on the earth? Why can't they just sink back down and go under the ground again? Sixth argument for the local flood theory. The drying wind would not have been able to dry up a global flood. We read in Genesis 8:1, but God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark, and God caused a wind to pass over the earth, and the water subsided. Well, my response to that is, yeah, wind is passing over the earth. That's certainly going to help, but there was probably other things working too. That verse doesn't say that it was only the wind that was drying up the earth. It could have been other things too, like the splitting of fissures in the earth and water sinking back down through the earth. Seventh argument in favor of the local flood. All the descendants of Adam were judged because they were all in Mesopotamia. Now, this again is a defensive argument. As I've already mentioned, universal judgment on the whole world, you would think, would judge all of mankind, not just the people in Mesopotamia. And again, I've mentioned earlier, with all those genealogies and those long ages, to think that people just stayed in Mesopotamia and didn't spread out beyond Mesopotamia is real hard for me to believe. Now, 2 Peter 3:5 through 6 says this, for when they maintain this, these people that are scoffing at Jesus' delayed return, it escapes their notice that by the word of God, the heavens existed long ago when the earth was formed out of water and by water, through which the world at that time was destroyed, being flooded with water. The argument goes like this. The world at that time was destroyed. The world at that time. In other words, just the world of Mesopotamia at that time, which is different than the world today. That's a little weak, in my opinion. We go now to Genesis. Now, well, let me say before I go on that this is just a brief overview of the arguments used. If you're really going to get into that issue, you got to go a lot deeper than I went. But this is not a podcast on local flood theory versus universal flood theory. You could probably do 10 podcasts on that. I'm just giving you something to organize your thoughts as you go to explore it in more detail if you so desire. We go to Genesis 7, verses 20 through 23. The mountains were covered as the water surged above them more than 20 feet. Every creature perished. Those that crawl on the earth, birds, livestock, wildlife, and those that swarm on the earth as well as all mankind. Everything with the breath of the spirit of life in its nostrils, everything on dry land died. He wiped out every living thing that was on the surface of the ground, from mankind to livestock, to creatures that crawl, to the birds of the sky, and they were wiped off the earth. Only Noah was left, and those that were with him in the ark. Now, the phrase in verse 22, everything with the breath of the spirit of life was wiped out, that was God's gift to man at the beginning, wiped out. We read in Genesis 1:30, for all the wildlife of the earth, for every bird of the sky, and for every creature that crawls on the earth, everything having the breath of life in it. Of course, that's talking about animals. Everything having the breath of life in it, animals including the human animal. I have given every green plant for food. So you see the distinction between green plants and those that have the breath of life in it. That's why you can have death before the fall if it's a plant, because that's not really death before the fall. when you got animals with the breath of life in it, just like Adam had the breath of life in him, and you say that these animals were dying before Adam was created, like the old earth creationists do, you got problems. So I mentioned that term, breath of life, because it's important in that big controversial theological debate. So in Genesis 1:30, we see animals have the breath of life. In Genesis 2:7, we see man has the breath of life. Then the Lord God formed the man out of the dust from the ground and breathed the breath of life into his nostrils, and the man became a living being. Now that gift of the breath of life was taken away because of sin as the flood wiped everybody out. Now notice that the wildlife died. Earth, birds, livestock, wildlife, wild animals. Think about if Adam had gotten off that ark after the flood and there's lions and tigers roaming around. They'd have been cooked, so the flood had to wipe them out too. Wasn't any way for them to climb a tree and get past the water. Now, the verse that says that 20 feet were over the mountains, I've already read that. Let me read it again. Chapter 7, verse 20, the mountains were covered as the waters surged above them more than 20 feet. Now, it's interesting, the Holman Christian Study Bible has above them in brackets. So you could read it this way. The mountains were covered as the water surged more than 20 feet, as the local flutters like to say. And of course, if that's the case, then you don't have any problem with skeptics, do you? Because it's only 20 feet. And that's not hard to believe. But a lot of skeptics say if you say it's 20 feet over the mountains, well, then you got a real problem. And they'll do all these calculations about, oh, if it was over the Mount Everest, there'd be enough water to sink the planet a million times, and Earth would fall out of its orbit, and all hell, all Gehenna would break loose, and that kind of thing. The young earthers, the creationists, respond to that by saying, no, the Earth back then was flatter. It was hills, not big, tall, high mountains. The reason that we have high mountains now is because of all the volcanic and earthquake activity that happened during the cataclysmic universal flood that thrust those mountains way up into the air. And so that's how we explain the fact that the waters covered the mountains by 20 feet or 15 feet. Excuse me, 20 feet. Now in verse 23, we see that God wiped out every living thing. Now, if you want to be technical and literal about that, he didn't wipe out every living thing. You could complain. Well, because we know that there were plants, because the dove in Genesis 8:11 brought a leaf of an olive tree to Noah. Let me read that. Genesis 8:11, when the dove came to him at evening, there was a plucked olive leaf in her beak. So Noah knew that the water on the earth's surface had gone down. So when it says every living thing, it's talking about living things with the breath of life. Notice the context of verse 23. The context is not about plants. It's mankind, livestock, creatures that crawl, birds of the sky. It's not talking about plants. So let's don't find a contradiction where there is none. Now, of course, another good skeptical charge that is often made is, well, where did the plants come from? How did they survive the flood? Well, I've got an interesting discussion of that, even using a quote from Charles Darwin in a previous audio, which I can't remember where it is right now. But there's lots of ways that seeds could survive the flood. Floating mats of vegetation, seeds in the bowels of drowned animals as the animals burst forth on the ground. Their bowels broke open and there's the seeds. And there's some other ways too, which I can't remember, but that's not a problem. There's a great article on that on the Answers in Genesis website if you're interested. We go now to verse 24 of Genesis 7. And the water surged on the earth 150 days. What does that mean? 150 days from when? Well, it could be from the beginning of the flood, as John Gill says, or it could be from the end of the 40 days rain, as Adam Clark says. And what this shows is that there might be some disagreement on the chronology of the flood. I've seen a nice table laid out in Answers in Genesis about the chronology, but I think it's probably controversial. If you really want to get into this, you just need to remember it. A lot of times the numerical lengths of time are ambiguous as far as their starting points or maybe their ending points. Ladies and gentlemen, I've finished Genesis chapter 7. The waters cover the earth. Now we're going to look in our next audio at Genesis 8, verses 1 through 19. The flood subsides. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.